The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
And this is Anton Savage in for Pat. Stubbornness is being blamed for the fact that the Republic of Ireland is overtaking the North in vaccine uptake in the under 30s. At least it is by Derry-based GP Dr. Tom Black. The numbers come despite the UK as a whole having a head start in the vaccine rollout. At least 64% of 20 to 29 year olds in the Republic have received one jab, compared to only 61% of people aged 18 and 29. Now, between 18 and 29. Obviously, those numbers seem relatively close, but the fact that Northern Ireland had such a significant head start in the rollout means that that gap is bigger than it initially appears. To discuss this, I'm joined by Ultan Power, who's Professor of Molecular Virology in Queen's University, Belfast. Ultan, good morning.
Good morning, Anton.
Is there much in the way of explanatory reasons for why there is that gap between North and South?
So the first thing I'd say, the gap is very small, Anton, so I wouldn't be making a huge big deal about that yet. And bear in mind that the age group implicated had only access to the vaccine from the end of May. So it's not like they were, you know, available, or the vaccines were available to them for a very, very long time. So that's one of the reasons. There are obviously concerns about being able to persuade and to encourage young people to get vaccinations. So what has happened in the Republic, you know, introducing the idea that if you don't get vaccinated, you won't have access to clubs and pubs, etc. That seems to have had a significant impact on encouraging young people to get vaccinated, because there's an active incentive to get the vaccine. Similar type of thing has happened in France when they brought in the law for, you know, where people couldn't get access to pubs, clubs and public transport if they didn't have vaccines. Then again, the numbers surged within a very, very short period of time. So maybe that's kind of the incentives that we need to look at here in Northern Ireland as well, to just keep it going and keep the momentum going to make sure that young people actually do take the offer of the vaccine.
Is the success of those measures to some extent predicated on an acceptance of or trust in the state that may, not saying necessarily, but may be more present in the Republic and in France than it might be in Northern Ireland?
In what sense, Anton? I don't quite follow your
question. A lot of people, when they brought out the link between vaccination and attendance, either travel or attendance at nightclubs and venues and all the rest of it, posited the theory that says, look, if you do that, you'll get the counterintuitive effect. People will actually say, you can stick it if you think you're going to tell me that I am only allowed to do something if I'm vaccinated. Now, as it washed out, that didn't end up happening. But in a country or in a province where you have a divided community, where trust in state authority may not be the same as it is south of the border, is it more likely that people may say, don't you try to leverage me into getting a vaccine?
I don't think so, Anton. I think, I don't have actual accurate figures, but what I'm hearing on the ground is that a lot of young people are just not bothered getting the vaccine because they consider the virus is not a major issue for them. So if there is an incentive like the need for a vaccination or a negative test or something like that to do something, that will focus their minds, I think, pretty quickly. So I don't think there's any alternative or different anti-government attitude here in Northern Ireland than there is elsewhere.
And putting on your molecular virology hat, from what sort of numbers would you aspire to seeing in particularly the younger cohort in terms of total vaccination? Are you happy if you get 80, or do you need 90?
So that's all dictated on, or predicated, I should say, Anton, on the necessity to get the vast, vast, vast majority of the people vaccinated, okay? And this is the same situation for these vaccines as it is for any vaccine for any other virus or bacterial infection. The issue is the goal really is to get what we call herd immunity. And the herd immunity, the numbers that need to be reached is calculated partly based on the transmissibility of the virus. Now, originally, when we had the original virus, say the Alpha strain or the original European strain that we had, that, you know, the first viruses that infected on the island, This is calculated based on the R rate, and that was around 2 to 3, thereabouts. Okay, so it meant that if we hit about 80-85% vaccination in the entire population, this is the whole population, including those individuals who can't be vaccinated, we would have probably reached herd immunity. However, as we're going on, the viruses are changing and mutating, and we know with the Delta variant that it is far more transmissible than the previous strains or previous variants. Well, now it looks like the R value is somewhere between 6 and 9. So that substantially increases the necessity to get even more people vaccinated to reach this infamous or famous herd immunity that will help protect overall society. And that now is heading up towards well over 85 and maybe in the 90s to get towards the herd immunity. So we really do need to get the vast, vast majority of people on board with vaccinations.
Do you believe that's going to be achievable?
It has been done with pretty much all of our other vaccines, like the MMR vaccines. We've reached over 95% vaccination for the intended population. So it is achievable, but it will take a lot, probably two things, a lot of good conversations, a lot of good advertisements by governments and by the departments of health to clearly indicate why it's necessary to have vaccines and what the overall societal benefit and the individual benefits are of these vaccines. So there is a lot of work to be done, but I do believe it is achievable.
And is that effective? Because one of the things, if you look back through history, there tends to be, to some degree, a correlation between vaccine discussion and vaccine hesitancy. The more it becomes an issue of public dialogue, the more people begin to question it. Whereas in periods when it's not particularly in the media and it's sailed by assumption, you actually have higher vaccine uptakes.
So there are for sure going, this is what I'm saying in terms of the necessity to have very clear messages about the advantages and obviously the potential risks, because again, we have to be totally transparent about all of the vaccines and the potential risks associated with them so that people can make up their minds. But what you find, and what you probably have been finding, Anton, is that when people talk about the vaccines, there's a lot of hyper, it's particularly in relation to COVID-19, there's been a lot of hyper concern about some of the very, very, very rare concerns and rare severe adverse events associated with these vaccines. And in parallel, there's almost an ignorance of the severe damage that the virus itself can do, even to young people. So I think there's, again, we need to address that and redress the balance of the advantages of the vaccine versus the potential seriousness of getting infected with the virus.
And without wishing to confirm them by over publicity, what are the misconceptions that you see as being most common?
Some of the concerns obviously relate to the recognized severe adverse events that have been reported in associated with these vaccines. So, for example, we know that there have been blood clots associated with the vaccines. We know that there have been severe allergic reactions to some of the vaccines. But what we need to put in context is that the frequency of those events are extraordinarily rare. It would be almost like you're winning the Euro Millions in reverse, if you want, to pick up one of these adverse events. Okay, so they're extraordinarily rare compared to the very severe problems and the frequency of very severe implications for infection with the virus itself. So this is one aspect that we have to find a means to be able to communicate that very, very clearly. The risks at this point are far, far lower than the benefits of the vaccine.
And I suppose part of that then, Alton, is also looking at the different types of risk, because early in the pandemic, the discussion was all about survivability and it was about mortality, whereas we're now seeing more and more about the lingering effect of long COVID.
Exactly. And I'm aware of a study that was done in the States. There was over 266,000 people in this study aged between 18 and 60 years of age. 14% of those individuals who became infected with the SARS-CoV-2 developed one or more symptoms of long COVID. That's a huge number of people who are having long-term effects from the virus, from infection, even though it's still the case that the vast majority of people are perfectly fine and probably will survive and have no necessary long-term effects of the infection. But 14%, that's a huge number of people. If everybody, and everybody eventually will become infected with this virus if we don't control it, that's a huge number of people that we'll have to deal with the consequences downstream of the actual infection itself.
Alton, thank you very much for joining us on the programme this morning. That's Professor Alton Power, who is Professor of Molecular Virology at Queen's University in Belfast.